Get out of the submarine. This is the most impactful note I have ever been given as a creative person. I say creative person and not playwright because when I was given this note, I was an improv actor and not yet a writer. I actually wasn't even an actor yet. I was taking improv classes at the time, and in one of the classes we were doing a scene that was set in a submarine. The scene was going nowhere. Those of us in it had no idea what to do with ourselves. Each of us reacted to the smallness of the space inside a submarine, something I learned from watching the movies Crimson Tide and The Hunt for Red October and Das Boot. They used to make a lot of submarine movies back in the day. Weird. Anyway, this scene was boring and going nowhere, and we improv students had no idea what to do about it. Paul D'Amato, our instructor, let us flail along for a while and then generously brought the scene to an end. "What happened?" he asked. None of us knew what to say. We didn't know what happened. We didn't know what to do. Paul, with his years of experience and wisdom beyond his age, said, "Get out of the submarine." It was so obvious a note, I was too stuck inside to see it. Of course, get out of the submarine. The scene is improv. There are no rules. We can go as far as our imaginations allow. I immediately replayed the scene in my mind 1,000 different ways, and all of them much better, funnier, and more interesting. But improv can't be played in retrospect. My improv days are way behind me, but that note has never left. I think of this all the time in my writing. Whenever I face that sense of being stuck, I ask myself, is this a submarine situation? Usually what has happened is I've unintentionally trapped my characters in a small space and now they're stuck. However, getting them out doesn't need to be literal. Getting out can manifest in some sort of surprise that moves the scene and elevates the play. I also think about the submarine with my life, when I have found myself stuck in a situation I don't want to be in. Am I in a submarine? I ask. If so, I make a change. And change is something my life has never been short of. Get out of the submarine is what Paul said. And he said that one small thing in the basement space of an improv class in Boston, Massachusetts, many years ago. And my writing and life are still impacted to this day. Thank you, Paul. And now I have a new idea for a play. 3 improv comedians hijack a submarine. And welcome to the Subtext Podcast. My name is Brian James Polak. Each month on the Subtext, I speak with another playwright about their life and their writing. And this month, I share a conversation I had with Mashuk Mushtaq Dean. Before we get to that, I want to remind you that the original archives of 24 episodes recorded between 2015 and 2017 are available on YouTube. And there are so many greats. I hope you have a chance to check them out. Dan O'Brien, Luis Alfaro, Sheila Callahan, Zakiya Alexander, Carla Ching, Madhuri Shaker, Jonathan Karen, Corey Hinkle, so many. Larissa Fasthorse, oh! You gotta go to youtube.com and search the Subtext Podcast and you'll find them, and trust me, you'll love them. All right, on to the episode. Dean is a core writer at the Playwright Center and winner of the Lambda Literary Award for Draw the Circle, which was produced at Playmakers Rep, Mosaic Theater, and Rattlestick Playwrights Theater. I love this play so much, and we end up talking a great deal about it because I read it right before I met Dean. His other full-length plays include The Vessel, Flood, The Betterment Society, which is published in the Methua Drama Book of Trans Plays, The Shaking Earth, and The Telegram, a live-staged radio play, which was commissioned and produced by Keene Company. He is a member of the New York Theater Workshop, Usual Suspects, and the Dramatists Guild. He is an alum of the Mayi Writers Lab and the Public Theater Writers Group. He earned his MFA from the Actors Studio Drama School, New School for Drama. We talk about that a little bit as well. This conversation was recorded at the rehearsal space for Shattered Globe Theater in Chicago, Illinois, in January of 2024. Good at giving a speech, and I get anxiety if anybody asks me to do it.
Yeah, I remember in grad school, I got an actor's training as well as a writer's training.
Yeah.
And so I was really surprised when they said a lot of actors have a lot of stage fright.
Yeah.
And they did. And it was interesting because I can get up with a little thing I've prepared and stand in front of people. I actually feel quite comfortable doing it. But if I just have to tell a story, it's like I skip the interesting part, get to the punchline too early, and it's as if I probably don't trust that the person has enough time or I'm going to be interesting enough to do it, so I sort of ruin my own story. But if I can write it down, then I can write a good story. Like, that's what I do.
Yeah.
But I'm not... I've had to, like, really work on take your time and trust that people are sort of along with for your verbal story.
Yeah. My problem is, if it's extemporaneous, I say too much. I go on and on and on, and I don't get to the point quick enough. People get ahead of me.
Yep.
And I think I need to include all this detail, but everyone's like ready for the end to come, and I'm not there
yet.
You're
not there yet.
But then if I prepare, I get caught up in the specificity of everything that I prepared and getting that right. So that throws me off, because then it's like I have to read in order to like nail it, because I'm not a trained actor. So I would be better at preparing somebody else's speech for them to deliver.
It's, I think in the writing, I cut and cut and cut till it's as tight as I can get it.
Yeah.
And then I can take my time with it, 'cause I know the rhythm of it, or I know.
Right. Right.
Anyway. Yeah.
When you studied, this is in grad school you were talking about, where you studied both performance and writing.
Yeah, I was at the Actors Studio Drama School when they were at the New School, and we were the class of the divorce. So there was this like ugly, ugly divorce between the New School, who wanted to have their own drama program, and the Actors Studio. So the contract came up for renewal. Everyone's like, great. And then like all the shit hit the fan. And like we had a year where teachers were just like, oh my God, am I going to have a job next year? And you're like, am I supposed to be having class? What's going on? Yeah, so but what I really appreciate about it was directors and writers all took all the acting training, and there were very few places I knew of at the time where you could do that.
Yeah.
Where writers weren't siloed to one area.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a sort of specific goal in mind with like a life or a career following this? Did you have a model?
No. Did you have a model? Do people have models?
I mean, my model was, I don't know, Tony Kushner, right? Like, I wanted to be a playwright who survived on writing, because I thought that was a possibility, you know, when I started out.
Yeah. I think I wanted to have something on a New York stage.
Yeah.
Before I went to grad school, I was sort of torn, because I wanted to write, and I wasn't sure if I wanted to write. I wanted to write everything. So I wanted to write novels, but I also wanted to write for the theater. But I also really like performing. And so I had heard if I went to school for fiction, I could write fiction, but I wouldn't necessarily be able to write for the theater. But if I went to school for theater, I could also write fiction. So I was like, well, I'll do that, and then I can do everything. But what happened was, I think dialogue really took root in my brain, and I just think in dialogue now. And so it's actually been a real challenge to go back to I paused for the train in the distance prose again. It took me like a while, and I am working on a prose piece now, but like it took me a while to like get my brain out of dialogue. But I wanted to, at the time, it was before I transitioned, and I knew if I was going to write characters that were remotely like me, there weren't that many actors at that time around, so I needed to perform also, possibly,
right,
in those shows.
Right.
And I did like performing, coming from a community theater background. I think now I've really retreated from it and I'm not looking to perform at all. Mm-hmm. But I really appreciate that I have the training and I understand what my actors are going, like part, what part of their process is.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I just have a deeper respect for what they do and how hard it is.
I've been thinking about this exact thing a lot lately because I'm not good on stage. I shouldn't be on stage. And I know that. I did a little bit of acting, so I know through experience that that's not the place for me. However, I have a couple things that I feel like I want to do. I want to write and perform. Like, is mm-hmm. it, I mean, maybe it's like a me in the character of me. So I'm kind of stuck on that because I know that that's not what I'm trained or built for, to be the delivery vessel for. But I also know that the way to communicate the way I want it to be communicated is to be the communicator.
Why are you not the vessel? Like, what makes you intrinsically not a...
I'm not comfortable on stage.
But that's so great to watch.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just very engaging. When somebody's afraid of doing something, but they do it anyway, there's something remarkable about it.
Yeah, for an hour?
Well, I don't know. But I feel like the person who's so comfortable on stage and is like, look at me, look at me.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
the one that gets me really bored.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I'll get there. But I've been thinking a lot yeah. about it. And then I read your play. The
Draw the Circle?
Chalk Circle play. Which is... it's like it's you telling your story and performing it.
Yeah. Except I don't play me.
And as I'm reading this, because I know the existence of this play, but I don't know the play until I crack it open, so I don't know what to expect. You play every character, 19 characters, if I got that right. And I'm like, oh, this is a version, and I'm just talking artistically speaking, a version of the type of piece that I dream of, right? But the performing dexterity it takes to pull off what you created in that play is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, Dale Orlander Smith. I was running in rep with her at Rattlestick, and she was so generous and gracious and sort of took me under her wing and gave me some advice. But I think she puts it really well when she said it's an athletic thing to do a solo performance. Like this play right now that I'm rehearsing in Chicago is going to run maybe just shy of 90 minutes. That whole solo piece was just shy of 90 minutes.
Wow.
And I don't stop talking
mm-hmm.
once. And it's so fast. When I used to do readings of it, I would have like a stool and a glass of water and my script. And I remember we moved into rehearsal. I said, Che, where's the water gonna live? And Che said, there's no water in this play. And I was like, but what if I get thirsty? And he's like, you get to the end of the play and then you can have some water.
Would you go off stage?
No, I mean, unless I was like really feeling sick, it just was, there's no break. There's no stop. And the idea was you're always ahead of the audience and the audience is always playing catch up. So there wasn't even, it wasn't as if the script was line, 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 pause, switch character, next line. It was line, line, line. And then I'm already like turning into the next character. I've already started my next line. It was that fast.
Mm-hmm.
But I was terrified of that play, and I partly because there's nobody else to play with. I think what I learned is what I love about performing is playing on stage with other people.
Yeah,
and there was nobody else up there with me, and I was terrified I would forget my lines, and I learned them like word for word. Like, I was hard on myself as well, and I think what I didn't realize, and I've really thought about this a lot over the years, is it all my actor friends would say, oh, you just do it long enough and it becomes a job, and then you just turn it on, you turn it off, but you'll be fine. And I was like, okay, but it's not happening. Like, I just feel terrified every night and kind of more terrified. And they said, no, it'll get better. It never got better, it just got worse. And I think what happened might have been something about, like, when I write, if it's, and I don't always write autobiography, but when I do, I can take something inside of me and I take it and it makes it external.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a thing, I can look at it, it's now a part for me. In the repetitiousness of the performing it, I think I pulled it back inside of me or wore down a wall between the present and the past. And mm-hmm. I'm starting to feel things that I didn't make sense for now, but I was feeling them as if I was 22 again.
Mm-hmm.
And it started to feel a little dangerous.
So that play, it, for people listening who don't know it, is, I mean, am I wrong to say it's autobiographical, right?
It's autobiographical.
It's not like a version of your, like, it was your
life. Yeah, I compound a few characters, but it's sure. autobiographical.
So did that add a level, like, you weren't just an actor performing a solo play?
Not, like, consciously, I was, once I, like, took off my writer's hat and I became an actor, I felt completely dedicated to making these characters fully realized mm-hmm. to the best that I could did in my ability. So consciously I didn't think, oh, this is my story, but I think something was happening in me that because I don't play myself, my arc is not like Dean's arc. I mm-hmm. mean, you get my story, but there's like the mother's arc, the girlfriend's arc, all these other arcs. But I think there wasn't a way where I like opened up what happened and then closed it again.
Yeah.
So it's weird. I mean, I play for an hour and a half people who are mostly mad at me. And so the audience, and Che put it this way, there's this triangle where the audience is looking at Dean. They're looking at a character talking about Dean. They're looking, Dean's playing that character who's mad at Dean, and there's just this thing that's happening.
Right. And so it comes to, as I'm reading it, I get to the point where I'm just like, oh, Dean's not in this. We're learning about Dean through multiple lenses. And when I'm thinking about it that way, I'm like, oh, I'm not getting, it's weird. It's this weird meta thing, right? Like Dean wrote this, but I'm getting Dean's story through Dean telling it through the lenses of multiple people. So where is the real Dean missing? Like that's what, like, this is what I was going through my head. And it was a fascinating sort of experience to think about. And it, like, your brain can kind of get like caught. And I wondered if that was, if that choice was in order to create a distance to tell the story.
No, it was, there were versions of it where I inserted myself into the story and I found that I defended myself. And it felt like bad writing and I hated it. So I cut it. So most of it was, I didn't want to give myself the opportunity to say, no, think this about me. Like I'm trying to show you that I'm good or right or something. So that to me never feels like good writing. So I had to cut it. So that was part of it. I think I'm not good at writing myself in that way. And I saw this really amazing show, by someone I didn't know that I know now, Jessica Dickey, and she did the Amish Project.
Yes.
And it, like, of all the solo shows I've seen, I would say that's like my top three, like blew me away.
Yeah.
And there was this thing where she is dressed as this Amish character. She's telling the story of these Nickel Creek shootings, the school that happened. She's playing everyone in the community, but you leave with this like really huge three-dimensional complicated sense of what this Amish community is. And it was so skillful, and I think in, as I was writing it, I don't think it was totally conscious in the beginning, but making that choice meant you would get a much more three-dimensional version, I hoped, of me than you would if I got up there and said, this is me.
Right.
And I actually don't think you would have.
How many years passed from when you wrote it to when the events of the play took place?
My main transition was like, God, what was that? 2005, 2006. I mean, it's like a few years, but it was around that time. And then 2009 is when I wrote it and had the first reading in 2010.
Wow.
And then with Che, like, we dramaturged it in every reading. Like, we tweaked it a little bit for a few years until 12. And then when I had a workshop in Philly, and then the main opening was at Playmakers. And that was really exciting for the premiere because they were under boycott for the HB2 laws that were going, I think it was HB2, but these bathroom bill laws that were happening. So the whole state was like very aware and conscious about trans people, bathrooms,
yeah,
and what it was doing to their economy. And so I was really grateful to be brought in, but it was actually such a unique and great audience to have because they were just so engaged. So I really liked, doing it there.
So in the play, you talk a lot about your relationship with your spouse, your parents, mm-hmm. or your girlfriend at the time, mm-hmm. and you end up marrying, and your family. Did the performance of each of these characters change the way you understood them? Like in writing what they had to say and then having to be the person to speak those characters' words, like, did that change anything in you?
I think the writing of it more than the performing of it.
Yeah.
The performing of it, I just was always a little nervous that I wasn't doing them justice and doing the best I could. So that was my stress. But in the writing of it, mostly for my parents, because with my partner, she had kept all these journals when we were going through it, when I was transitioning, and she let me read them, which was very generous. Mm-hmm. And we talked about it. We have, you know, very open. So nothing was a surprise there. But with my parents, I would say the biggest thing is I probably went through my transition feeling like they were ashamed of me. They wanted to keep me a secret. There was all this stuff that felt bad. And I think in the writing of it, I understood their fear for me and a parent's fear for their kid in a way that I didn't or couldn't before. Mm-hmm. And how much, and also based on their culture and the ways that they live their own lives, which are, they're not going to go march in a parade for anything, for their own things. You know, they keep their head down, they're immigrants here. I guess it taught me something about a point of view from theirs that I didn't understand.
Yeah. Yeah. The word normal is thrown around a bunch. I'm not condescending the use of the word.
Oh, yeah.
I just, that you just tossed it around. I just mean that the word normal comes up multiple times in the play. And, as I'm hearing that word, I kind of like, I cringe on it because now as like an adult, you know, I use the word normal, like be normal, define what normal is. Like, mm-hmm. And then now as an adult, I realize that the concept of normality is so defined by an individual that mm-hmm. there is no, to the point where there isn't actually a normal. The normal is only based on whatever this individual person defines as normal. Mm-hmm. And, because I think of my life relative to my family's life, and mm-hmm. my family would say normal is getting up and having a 9-to-5 job and mm-hmm. paying bills, getting a house, having children, going on vacation.
Yeah.
And I haven't done those things. So am I abnormal? But I am normal. I'm just a totally normal random person.
Are you?
At the same time.
Are we? I'm just kidding.
So are you. Like,
what? Well, I don't know. In some ways, I push back on that. Not I push back, but just that sense of like, I used to take pride in not being normal. At least, you know, when I was younger, it was like a point of pride to be like, I guess it's the way like in a previous generation must have been like those squares. And
yeah,
I'm this like cool artist. And I was like,
I know. Yeah.
So like just to the other side of that, I think is also it's fun and hard to be what we are. But we exist in this place, like, outside of convention. I think the artist has such a unique societal role. We are hard to pin down, hard to define.
I kind of wish... I feel like maybe this is something to push back on, too. The artist is more respected in retrospect, in studying, mm-hmm. in looking back, than in the present. So the role, I don't feel like we artists in any form of art have a role in our society, but in 30 years, mm-hmm. a lot of work of the artists of our time will be looked at and studied.
Yeah.
Right? But it doesn't feel like artists are seen as a welcomed aspect of society.
No, and we're certainly not, I think, supported or subsidized in this country. But I really like the way Jorge Cortinos puts it. He has an essay sort of about activism and art, but just this idea that like we serve this function to step outside of whatever the status quo is, or the society or the culture or the government, whatever, and poke at it and provoke mm-hmm. it and ask really uncomfortable questions. And that's good. Like, somebody has to do that. That's really important for us to do. So I mean, art is very broad, and there's a lot of entertainment, and there's usefulnesses for that. But I think this idea of like provoking and poking things that don't like to be poked feels like my job and my responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that means like with Draw the Circle, it makes everyone uncomfortable. So the trans people in the audience are somewhat uncomfortable watching this play. And the parents or non-trans people in the audience are also uncomfortable watching this play. And they're both comforted a little bit. And they have to wrestle with that. And that, to me, feels like a success in my writing. Mm-hmm. But if I just made people like me comfortable and everyone else uncomfortable, that would not feel like a success to me.
But as you're creating it, are you thinking in terms of what's going to be comfortable or uncomfortable? Or are you simply writing what you have to write, and then the result is the result?
I mean, I'm following some artistic impulse I have.
Yeah.
But I know if I'm not somewhat uncomfortable, or it doesn't feel dangerous or scary to me, then I'm not in the right spot.
Mm-hmm.
So I also always somewhat feel like if I haven't eviscerated myself, and I don't mean like, oh, let me have therapy with you. Like, that's not what I mean by it. But if I haven't felt that sense of vulnerability, then I haven't gotten there yet.
Mm-hmm. Was Draw the Circle your first play? Like, I don't know, we talk about it in different ways. Like, was this your breakout? Was this like...
I would say it's the first one that was professionally produced.
Yeah.
So, and it's the first one people know me for.
Yeah.
There was a play that had a Fringe Festival production before that, you know, that was more self-produced and, things like that.
So how was it that theater, that writing and performing became a thing for you? Like, where'd that come from?
Yeah, I don't have this origin story that all my colleagues seem to have, which was, I saw this amazing play and I was this old and it changed my life and I knew I wanted to be in the theater. Like, nothing like that has ever happened to me. My family did not go to the theater. I went with school field trips to the Bushnell in Connecticut and saw something like twice a year. So what happened was, I knew I wanted to write. I was very inspired by John Boy from the Waltons. and I think from a young age knew I wanted to write. And then I toyed with the idea of theater, but I don't think seriously until I went to college. I dropped out of college because I got really depressed. I had to spend some time getting better. And in that time, I started to do community theater.
Mm.
And it was very difficult because I didn't know who I would play. And at first, I got cast as these women, sort of frumpy women, and I just was so uncomfortable because I never wore a dress at that point, ever. And I just was like, oh, I hate this. And then I got cast as a butler in some, like, farce, and I was beside myself with joy that I got to dress up in this three-piece tuxedo every night. And
did you know who you were at that point?
I didn't know. I didn't know I was trans yet. I knew at that point that I identified as butch, so I knew I was a really masculine. I'd come out as not queer yet, but bisexual at that time. And I knew within the women's queer community, there was this role for butches. Like, there was a place where we existed and there were other people like me. And so I felt pride in it and comfortable in it. It was a source of a lot of grief with my family, but out in the world, and I was in Northampton when I went back to school. So it was like, lesbian central, I was very comfortable there. But understanding like how I would fit into theater was confusing. But what happened was I finished up my undergrad at UMass and I just wanted to take the classes I wanted to take. So I wanted to take acting classes. I wanted to take writing classes. They said, you have to write a final project. I said, I guess I will write a play because that seems to wrap them all together.
Mm-hmm.
And I was good at it. And I think I was surprised that I was good at it.
Mm.
But my backstory on that is, that's where it sort of like appeared in my conscious mind, but I can backtrack it and see that at different points I wrote, academic papers as plays, but I couldn't tell you why. Mm. It's not because I said I thought I was a playwright. I think it's because I felt like they wanted me to write an essay to tell the truth, and I felt like the truth existed between the two arguments, not in any one argument. It was always going to be not quite enough. Mm-hmm. But if I could show the argument, the audience could see all of it, and that was where the truth was. And to me, intellectually, yes, and then even more so between your emotions and my emotions and the messiness of us is the truth of us. Mm-hmm. And that feels more true than anything I can say in an essay.
Were you reading anybody's work in this time period?
I feel like I'm supposed to say yes, but I don't. I was reading novels mostly at that time.
Yeah.
Not until theater classes did I start reading plays.
In grad school?
No, undergrad. I took a few playwriting classes, and we had to read, you know, Pirandello and Susan Laurie Parks and people like that.
I mean, did you find any that were really, like, speaking to you?
At that time, I remember Six Characters in Search of an Author, like, really spoke to me. And I was probably still, one, getting better from my depression and seeing fragments of myself and trying to put it all together. Mm. But Susan Laurie Parks' Top Dog Underdog, I just thought was brilliant. And I've never, and this is not to disparage any production, but I've never seen the production that I've seen in my head of that. And I would like to someday.
It's one of my favorite plays, and I've never seen any production of it. I've seen, like, scene work.
Yeah.
Like, in grad school.
I just feel like it's so, yeah.
Yeah.
So that is my origin story for writing. But it's interesting now, because I think we get really siloed in whatever artistic field we're in, but I kind of think we're creators. And when I go to these artistic residencies, I occasionally meet somebody who has not allowed themselves to be siloed and just is making in all different genres and fields. And
yeah.
And I, you know, of course I used to write poetry, and some was bad, but some was good. And I now write more essays, and I have a knack for essays, even though I just said there's something about the essay, but I have a knack for, I think, an essay that uses personal narrative to, like, weave a story to get to a point.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm working on a memoir, which is really kicking my ass, but probably because I'm afraid to write it. But it's interesting. It's hard for me. I still think in dialogue and in scenes. Like, it's just how I process my life.
I just want to go back to something you just said.
Yeah.
Your Draw the Circle is a memoir on stage, and it's so moving and vulnerable and provocative and honest, and you performed it, and then you just said the writing the memoir is scary, and I'm like, is it scarier? Like, I felt like it seems like you did the hard part, scary part already.
I don't know what, somehow it was hard to write, but maybe because I was writing it and I had deadlines, and it was also part of something that was expected. It was shorter. There's something vast about a novel or a memoir.
Yeah.
And I think my memoir is coming out more like a novel, and it's so vast, I feel a little overwhelmed. Like, I can't see the other shore and I don't know where we're going. And it's not that I'm not good at prose, but it feels so different to be in it. Like, theater, there's like I know what my characters are, I hear them, there's an action, there's a thing. Here I'm in this world of the narrator.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's more poetry, I think my work is somewhat lyrical anyway, but there's like a poetical prose thing happening in the...
Yeah. I do appreciate what I'm hearing as far as, like, Jen Silverman defines as diversifying your practice. She said that to me on this podcast a couple years ago, and so it's like started to unlock something in me as far as how I create. And so I like that you're echoing the same kind of thing, like, don't be siloed creatively. Like, write poetry, write a memoir, write a book, write a play.
Yeah, I just worked with Janaki Rampura, who's a friend and colleague who I've known for a while, and we worked at the Playwright Center, but I met her as a puppeteer. Then she was, like, in Spain doing conceptual art. Then I ran into her in New Mexico, where she was doing sculpture. And then we just worked on a devised play at the Playwright Center, and I just think she is someone who, you know, who thinks in these other ways. And for me, there's I get caught up in like dumb practicalities of like I understand the world of theater and like how to move my work forward.
Yeah.
I feel very beginner about like, well, I have this stack of poems. Like, what do I do with them? Like, who do I send? Where do I just feel like very lost.
Yeah.
Like I've never done this before.
Yeah. How do you then move that forward? It's easy to know. It's not easy to move it forward, but it's easy to know what you're supposed to do to move a play forward.
Yeah. And especially a play with text. So I went to the Playwright Center and I wanted to just play with my process and say, well, how do I create in new ways? So half the experiment was just, what is this? Can I do something in a new way? So I came in with no pages, a few prompts. I wanted to write and direct it. It's going to be mostly movement based. Let's see what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at the end, I felt bigger. Like not, that's going to sound like an ego thing maybe, but it just, I felt like the breadth of my wings as a creative person were much broader than I realized. And in the end, I had the score.
Yeah.
And I have no fucking clue what to do with the score.
Yeah.
I cannot send it to all the playwrighty places that I would go to. I don't know how to work on it. And nor do I want to self-produce.
Right.
Raise money, start a theater company. That's just not my jam.
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost as if the creating part is the easy part.
Which is so not true.
I know. An arts festival in the fall, I met a clown juggler person
mm-hmm.
who works in, I'm not sure how they define it, but like narrative, like he creates these narratives, and he showed me one of his scripts, and it was awesome to see because there is no dialogue. It's movement based and it's clown based. And he writes it all out. Like what happens, and he creates, and you see there's truly a narrative there without a word spoken, and it was
clown work.
It was eye-opening to see it. I really loved it.
Yeah, I would love to work with more clowns. I just think it's fascinating the way they're. Yeah, it's fascinating.
I love cross-discipline collaboration hugely. Just like I like when I like videos of different types of animals who are friends. the lion and the puppy dog.
Uh-huh. There's a lion and a Rottweiler that I see periodically. That they seem to be buddies.
I love that.
So
after the success of Draw the Circle, did your creative life open, and your opportunities open? Did you become defined as like the person that does this, like? What was the sort of like aftermath?
It was interesting. There was a little, I was a little scared at the end of that because I could have kept performing it and I had to stop because it was just not good for me anymore. So I actually had to cancel a show in Philly, which I felt really bad about. I was going to be at Interact with Seth Rosen, who I really like, and he had supported the play for a long time, and I had to call him and say I couldn't perform it. Mm-hmm. Which I felt so shitty about. But I couldn't. I just couldn't do it anymore. So it was weird to know this play could keep on going and I have to stop. And now theaters aren't going to, at least for a while, produce it without me doing it because they don't see it without me yet.
Mm-hmm.
As you know. So that's one thing. I think it established something. I mean, I don't know about you, but I like walk around feeling like five people know me. And so you're like, so when I say like earlier before you turn the recorder on, how do you know me? There's a part of my brain that just thinks five people know me and I don't understand how anyone else knows me, which is probably good for me. I don't want my ego to think that more people know me. just like try to keep it small. But I think it established me somewhere, but still like very low. You know, it's like one production that's been done, a few productions of the same play. So it's that weird thing of, are we still early career? Are we not early career? So that lasted for a while. There was something I was going to say that it's now going to slip my mind. I'll now be known as the playwright who can't keep all their thoughts together. I'm losing it.
That's going to be the headline for this episode.
It is. To be like, and then he went blank. What was your question? The question was, did it open creative doors?
I was curious if the success of that play opened doors or defined you.
Oh, the define me thing. I think a lot of people, and mostly from the queer community, asked me if I would write another one. and if I would write another one about someone like them.
Mm.
And I said, no, mm-hmm. I will not. But you are welcome to do that. That's great. And I think I'm right in saying that it surprises people that every play that I write is pretty different from the play I wrote before. So I have this one solo one. I have, at this point, no desire to do another one, nor to write another autobiographical play because I've already done it. And so even the memoir, someone saw Draw the Circle, said, I would love to see this in a memoir. Would you write the memoir of this? And I said, not like this, because I've already written it. I don't want to repeat it. I won't learn anything.
Mm-hmm.
So then to me, it's like, how is the memoir different from this? And like, what is the story I'm telling? So that's a different thing.
Yeah.
But I always want to learn something formally about form and challenge myself in some way. Like this one here, which I hope you'll see at Chatter Globe, is a modern absurdist play called Flood.
Right.
I'll get you a ticket whenever you want. And so that's very different. And I think like writing it, I found something that I've been looking for a couple of plays about language and something that like, I feel like I can hold more meaning when it's not strictly like plot linear is kind of reductive, but I'm able to stack meaning in this way where like I have more symbols or I have a finite number of symbols and they hold multiple reference points or meanings within the play.
Can you say more about that? You've made these discoveries about writing and how you can write and how are they manifesting mm-hmm. in this play?
It's like I was able in this play to create something that is out of time. Like it's fascinating. So in a naturalistic play, and forgive me, world, that I sometimes use realism and naturalism in the wrong way, so whatever. But in a play that is based in realism is maybe what I mean. Sometimes you need more information dramaturgically to get people along. In a play like this, too much information confuses the audience. Sometimes they need less information. And when they get confused, you have to cut something because you've gotten them a little.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like how to keep it specific enough that they're here, but not so complicated that people wonder where they were yesterday or where they're going tomorrow, that they can exist here forever.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to create something I feel like that is like out of time, could be anywhere, but still is specific enough that it that we all relate to it and feel that universality. And I have parents that are feeling like very 1950s and of a certain era, and kids that are feeling now and a little bit tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And the husband is working on a project. So there's a project. The wife has a teapot and she's waiting to have tea with him. And the teapot means so many things to her. It means the end of the waiting, intimacy, the time they can finally sit together and she can be with this person that she fell in love with 50 years ago,
mm-hmm.
that she's lost over the course of a marriage. And is he afraid of the teapot? You know, and mm-hmm. it can all be held in the teapot
right.
without it having to be a lot of complicated conversations about it. And in some ways, like I almost feel like by excavating some of the subtext, because they say a lot of things, but very matter-of-factly without having these. This is where clowns are great, because instead right. of having a real method complicated four-tiered emotional response, they're like happy, they're sad, they're longing, they're this, but they're going through all these like staggered emotions. And I feel like then there's this like whole subterranean underground that's like deeper. There's like a whole other meaning layer that is underneath that I'm able to get to, that it feels different than what
yeah.
I write.
This is what I love about process, about creative process. It's, I mean, I pretty much only am writing plays at the moment, but taking a play into a workshop or even just privately with no audience with like director and actors and starting to identify what do they need to hear, mm-hmm. they being the audience, what do they not need to yeah. hear, and then just like slashing, cutting, moving. I love all that to get into the head.
Yeah.
Because it is kind of a, you know, we're manipulating.
Sure.
We're figuring out how best to manipulate.
I mean, manipulation's not a bad word.
No, I don't mean it in a
negative
sense. No,
I don't think you do,
sense.
But I think
yeah.
in parlance sometimes people
yeah.
do. And everything is manipulation to some degree. Like, that's
yeah.
just, I think it's how you do it and why you do it.
Yeah. And I think that's when playwrights are at their best, is when they're able to really think about an audience. And I think this is probably a lot of playwrights will push back on this, and I've heard them do that many times about the relationship between what we're writing and the receivers, the audience. Mm-hmm. And lots of playwrights I've spoken to are like, I don't care. Like, it doesn't matter to me because mm-hmm. I'm writing what I'm going to write. And you know, whatever, that's fine. Mm-hmm. Everybody has their own thing. I love to constantly think about that relationship and how the thing that's being created is being received, because this is like, we create it to be put into this room mm-hmm. where people are going to sit, buy tickets and sit and experience yeah. our story. Otherwise, why not just write a book or a poem?
Yeah.
You know? And this is when I teach, do you teach?
I have taught a little bit, but I'm not, I don't do it
often. This is the button on what I was just saying. This is what I try to convey to brand new writers, is that start off respecting that there's, if you're going to write a play, that there's a relationship between what you're writing and the receivers of it.
Yeah. I've thought about this a lot. I think in my own writing, at this point, I think the audience is subconscious. Like, I am, within my craft, I am always aware a little bit of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think about it consciously. I'm really just in these characters' worlds. But I do, when I've talked to younger writers, talk about, like, the gaze of the audience. I think it exerts force on you and the play and, like, and something that's happening. And you exert a force back, and something between the two. And there's something, because there's something about gatekeepers, and like, who are you writing for? And I think sometimes people write for what will get through the gatekeepers, and that's its own thing. Like, if you are writing outside your own lived experience, I'm not someone who's going to say you shouldn't do that. But sort of, what's the work it takes? What's the pressure that comes at you?
Right.
What are you trying to say, and what's your gaze through it? Like, how do you find your truth in that, whatever that is? I mean, I still want a really complicated artistic world where we get to write all kinds of things. And I don't just have to write Draw the Circle 48 times because I don't want to do it.
Yeah.
You know, I want to write about, there's whole worlds I want to write about that are not, that of course about me, but like me in the dream sense where I'm you and I'm everybody.
Yeah.
But not me and my, like, tribal identity sense, which I'm not, it's fine, like, it exists, but it's not all of me.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was sort of curious about and asking, if you felt, I didn't use this word, but if you felt cornered after Draw the Circle into having to do that kind of,
I think I was work. Aware that it, that expectation would be there, and I didn't feel, I don't know, it's not like it had been, like, this huge Broadway success and someone's like, I'm going to produce your next Broadway show, but it's got to be this, and then I have to make a decision. It was just, you know, me in my quiet room being, what am I going to write next? And I was already feeling like I wanted to go more global and more political, so I ended up with The Shaking Earth, which was about the Sikh massacres in India and refugees here. And so that was like, okay, so, like, I understood something about tautness, and it was almost like I, like, love Tony Kushner and had spent a lot of time with his work and had to learn that I'm not inherently a talky playwright. Like, that's not the truer version of my voice.
Mm-hmm.
And then I found more resonance with Fornes, and I would spend a lot of time with her work, which I just love so much. And so for multiple plays, I was living in a Fornes world with Conduct of Life and Mud. And then, like, with Flood and I think where I'm going, I've been living in, like, Beckett and Ionesco.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't understand them in my 20s. I just didn't get it. And then I aged up, and something about my life experience and being older, and I get it. And maybe the cultural moments we're in, too. It feels like there's such a defined what's right, what's wrong. I'm missing more nuance. I want more nuance in the world. And things feel hard to say, even to people who are perhaps politically aligned with you. It feels harder to disagree without catastrophes happening.
Yeah.
That I've, all of a sudden, like, these plays feel like you can speak directly and obliquely at the same time to get to something that is getting too hard to say,
mm-hmm.
but has to be said.
Yeah.
So it's just, yeah. So I understand something that I didn't 20 years ago.
And I love that. I love re-experiencing things becoming aware that we do change, and the persons we are sitting on this couch right now today will be different in 12 years. And I can read a play today and be like, and then come back to it.
Yeah.
I've evolved more and re-experience it in a new way.
Who's your playwright? Or I guess, did you have like a trajectory at all?
Oh boy. I am like a inspiration sponge. I almost love and inspire, and this seems like I'm a politician the way I'm answering this question. I totally know it. But I'm almost inspired and like moved and by everything that I read. We're not only talking about Draw the Circle, but I just read it. So it's like so in my head. But again, so this is inspiring and moving me. Jen Silverman's work totally inspires and moves me. Like Angels in America inspires and moves me. I can't write like Tony Kushner. Like I'm not an intellectual. I'm a feeler and not a thinker. I come back to that play. Godot, I come to. And I don't understand it. I still come back to it. Our Town, I come back to all the time. All of Rajiv Joseph's plays really inspire me in a lot of ways. I'm talking to Matthew Paul Olmos later today, actually. And he wrote this play that in sort of like a writer's retreat workshop that I was part of almost a decade ago, called The Living Life of the Daughter Mira. And it has stuck with me. I've never seen a production of it. But it is like, it's so moving to me. It's so poetic. And I carry that inspiration all the time. And so I just keep collecting all these inspirations. So it's hard. I don't have a, and then Luis Alfaro was like one of my, you know, grad school professors, and he cracked me open emotionally, and all of his plays and all of his solo work that I have seen does that. Each time I experience his work, whether he's performing it or it's a production, I am cracked open again.
That's my goal. I mean, that's what I hope we do, or I hope I do in theater, is that cracking people open.
Yeah.
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 That feels like the right. Yeah. I feel like in the theater, like, everything goes dark, and if we're really sneaky, you can like reach into somebody's heart and like move it a little bit. And then when they wake up, they have to like somehow deal with it, like who they think they are and like what's moved a little bit and how to reconcile that whole thing. And that to me is like part of the magic of what we do.
Yeah. If you can get that to happen, that is magical. I just want somebody to think about whatever it is.
But you want someone to feel too, because you said
Yeah. I mean, I don't know why I'm using these things interchangeably, because they're not interchangeable. But I want there to be something to stay with them, and not have it end when they leave the threshold. Like that's the bar. That's a pretty low bar.
I don't know. That's my bar. Like if I go to the theater and I forget about it on the way home, then I feel really down about. But I love it if like the next day I'm still thinking about it, even if I didn't fully understand it, but it stayed with me enough that I'm working on it, or I'm still sad about a character. Like I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw a production of, You Got Older by Claire Barron at Steppenwolf a couple years ago. And I couldn't stop thinking about it. So I went back and saw it again, and I'd never done that before. Yeah. I brought somebody. I was brought to the first one, so I got a free ticket, and I was just like, worth the investment to now buy some tickets. And I love when it stays with me. And I want, after somebody seeing my play, I just want something to stay with them and have some kind of ripple effect or residual, you know, something.
Mm-hmm.
And what that is, like, I don't know, like, life changing. I'm not thinking in terms of like Brecht, right? Like, yeah. A butterfly flaps its wings, right?
Yeah. I mean, Withdraw the Circle was really easy to see how emotionally impacted people were. And I did a talk back almost every single performance, which I know some playwrights hate, but if it's curated really specifically, I think you can have an amazing conversation. But it put people in such an emotional place.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my hope is like, yes, Flood is like, I'm drawing from Beckett, Ionesco, and these playwrights, but I'm still a heart-based writer. That's just my way in. So I hope there's still that, but it is a little bit thinkier. You have to figure out the symbols, and it's not quite as easy is not the right word, but it's a different way to receive a play. But when you were talking before, and I was thinking about the one that came to mind for me, is I saw The Intelligent Homosexual's Guide by Kushner, and I remember getting on the subway and being like, nobody talk to me. Like, I'm still processing what happened, and unless you're talking about the play, I don't want to talk about anything else. And I wish we all, like, went to a bar afterwards and just kept talking instead of, in New York, everyone gets on their train and goes home.
Yeah.
Or it's so late and you have to travel an hour, but I sort of want the arguing, wrestling, I don't know, what did it mean to you? What did it mean to me?
Yeah.
Like, I want that.
Yeah. Now that you've stated it that way, in addition to the bar that I mentioned before, as far as like having some residual impact, I want people to leave the theater talking beyond, did I like it? Did I not like it? Mm-hmm. Just something that is not just a thumbs up, thumbs down, like an engagement
mm-hmm.
in something. And I think if that can happen, that's pretty great.
This is where I think, maybe I'm naive, but I don't think so, but a post-show conversation that is curated can keep people moving on the play. It's not like, I don't think it's like a for everything, but like, I feel like if I can get them talking to each other and starting to trust their thoughts and feelings about it, rather than sort of being like, okay, that was a nice day at the theater and I'm done. Like, I'm hoping that that they'll then go out and keep talking about it.
Yeah.
And also, like, I remember the one class I did teach, I was also trying to get them beyond thumbs up and thumbs down. I was like, was it trying to do? Could you tell? Did you feel like it did it well? Did it surprise you? Like, where did it go off the rails for you? Like, what was that? Like, I don't know. I just wanted to think and engage. And I feel like when I was at the, it was a New York Theater Workshop, and we were part of the 2050 Fellowship, so this was like a decade ago, and they took us on a field trip to Montreal for the Transamerique Theater Festival. And like multiple things blew me away about this. One, the whole city seems to go out to this festival.
Mm.
All the tickets are super affordable. People don't care if they like it or not. They go and they're happy to hate it or fall asleep at it or be angry about it. But those are all good responses to theater.
Mm.
And I thought that was so great. And then because we were on this field trip and heading to a hotel, we all went out afterwards and argued about it, and someone loved it and someone said they slept through it. And that was all part of it. And I loved that. And I sort of miss that.
Mm-hmm.
I wish we had more of a culture of that.
Yeah. I experienced that in, some trips to Poland, seeing like the Central Eastern European mm-hmm. theater there in Warsaw and in Krakow, and very much that kind of relationship. Like, people are coming out and they are talking about, like, they are not going home after they're going to the place,
right.
Where the bar or wherever.
No. Or I don't know, as a playwright, I want to go to that bar when they're wrestling about it, but I hope that it's happening.
Right, right. Yeah, you want it to happen. If it's your play, you want to get on the subway and go home immediately.
Like, yeah. Someone take me out for drinks and, like, hide me in a corner. Maybe.
Right. Drinks, but in another borough.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When you started out, and you're like, I'm going to write plays, I'm going to perform, I'm just going to be this, I'm going to mm-hmm. be a theater artist. Did you have an idea of what that career would look like, or even like the idea of a career?
I I think it's a hard question to answer. I didn't know where the money would come from. I don't think I knew how I was going to make it all work yet. But, you know, I was temping. I had this, you know, a day job for a while. This is not what you're asking me, though, so let me reorient to this question. I think I wanted to write something important. And I'm sure my ego is like, I want to be on a New York stage. I want to be on a bigger New York stage. I want to be in multiple parts of the country, and I would like to win awards. Some part of my brain, whether I like it or not, wants that validation. And I want to write something that feels meaningful, because when I think of writers like Kushner and Fornes and the people I grew up with, but then also novelists, who I feel like I sit with these books and they mean so much to me. And to have written something that could, as you aside, I sometimes feel the writing is bigger than I am. Mm. If I write it well, mm-hmm. I've caught something that is beyond me. And like, writer Dean is much wiser than human Dean. And that, to like have created something feels meaningful in and of itself. And I think that's what I wanted most, or how I thought about it. And yeah, I want validation.
Do you feel like you've done that?
This is where the thing is, like, it's never enough, which is like such a, I mean, in like Buddhist sense, I get that. Yeah, I just want it to be on any stage in New York. Then I want it to be on a bigger stage. Like, yes, I think that Draw the Circle was meaningful. I put something out into the world that was art. It was meaningful. It felt true. And then I wanted to grow as an artist and do it again, but like in an even more so way. So, yes, and I'm trying to be aware of, Patine, if you like had to stop writing today, for whatever reason, you broke all your hands, you just could no longer, could it be enough what you've done? And I think that I should say yes. And it's so hard to be an artist, and without some drive that's a little irrational in your desire to be out there, what propels us to do this really hard, mostly impossible thing, which is believe in ourselves enough to get our work out there and put it in front of people and risk everything to make a difference, to matter, to leave something behind. Which is why I think it's really, this is my soapbox, it's really cruel to say to somebody, you don't matter, or your identity makes you irrelevant in the world, which I think it's so weird to be the like queer brown person who's like, hey guys, this is not cool. But hey guys, this is not cool. Like, I don't matter because I'm queer and I'm brown. I matter because I have something interesting to say about the world, and I have an interesting way of saying it. And part of being queer and brown may add to that experience or my lens, but so does like losing a parent early, or having a near-death experience, or having a kid brother who's disabled. There's like so many things that are not about tribal identities. And I wish we would be a little bit more thoughtful about that. I think I hear that in the world in a way that makes me feel upset, frustrated, sad about it.
Mm. Do you feel successful?
No. Am I supposed to say yes?
What is success to you?
Yeah, what is success? Yes and no. I feel like I am making art that I believe in, and I am successful in putting good work out into the world. If success, though, is having a lot of big theaters produce you, then not really, not yet. Or making money, but I think even the best in our field don't make a lot of money doing what we do. But I feel like I'm being honest and I'm pushing myself. I sometimes don't write for long stretches and wrestle with that, but I'm still wrestling with it, and that's the work, and that's okay.
Mm.
And on the other hand, I'm super successful because, And I don't want to, like, what's it called? What's the word I'm looking for?
Jinx?
Yes. I don't want to jinx anything. But I have a partner of 24 years. I'm who I'm madly in love with. And, like, my happiest moment is to sit on a Sunday and do zero work, because we don't work on Sundays and we don't look at screens on Sundays, and lay on the couch and do a crossword. And I wanted that my whole life. Like, so I have it. And I won't always have it, because, like, she's not going to live forever, or I'm not going to live forever. But I want to make good work. But the more important thing is I want to live a good life and be a good human with her, with the people I'm around. And I think, so this is what I would say that I feel like is one of my discoveries in the last 5 years, is making good work does not make me a good person. Being a good person allows me to make good work. And so the main thing is, like, my groundedness. If my whole wrestling at McDowell is, like, me wrestling with myself when I come out with the page, I feel shitty about it. I wish I had written a whole novel, of course, or three novels. But I was working on being a truer, more honest person and walking through my own gauntlet and burning myself in the fires of the whole thing. And so then whatever work that comes from me will be truer. And I think that's the main thing.
Thank you, Dean, and thank you to Shattered Globe for allowing us to use the space to record our conversation. For more information about what Dean is up to, check out his website, mashukmushtaqdean.com. Thank you, Rob and Ali and Kalundra at American Theater Magazine. American Theater is a program of Theater Communications Group. You should become a member and receive hard copies of the excellent American Theater publication. Go to tcg.org for more info. Music from this episode is from Melody Ayers Griffiths. The theme song for the subtext is from International Pen Pal. This episode was produced and edited by me. KJ Jarbo is our associate producer. Thank you for listening. The play filling me up this month is Welcome to Fear City by Carolee Corthron. This play is as much about the people in it as the place they inhabit. It's a brilliant work.